Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 14th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Becoming the Whole Church, presented by Reverend April Johnson. Number is JO-A-2006-05. Let's listen in.
As many of you know, I'm April Johnson, and I've talked about why I'm here and why I do this work a few times, but basically this is the thing that I would do for free. And all of us have that thing that we would do for free, no matter what we do it, you know, because it's who we are. And racial justice is who I am. It's one of those things that caught me. And I am intricately connected with it and unable to disconnect myself as often as I would like from doing this work. So this afternoon what I would like to do is we have been talking over the course of the last 4 days about troubling scriptures. And if any of you guys were here with me on Monday in this room, I showed you a book that is pretty much the foundation of the work that I'm presenting this week called Troubling Biblical Waters by Cain Hope Felder. And in that book, he teases up some scriptures and some typical scholarly interpretation. He himself is a New Testament scholar. In terms of how race, class, and family are lifted up in the scriptures. And so what we have been doing all week is looking at some troubling scriptures, particularly as they are read, I won't say interpreted, read with a racial lens, or worse, with a monocultural lens. In that sometimes we read scriptures and we assume that everyone in the biblical context was just like we are now in our current context. And so we've been having this conversation all week about how we bring our social cultural lens to the scriptures. And so today what I want to do is, the last 2 days I have left the groups with some very disturbing texts to almost any of us. And what I'll do is I'll review real quickly what the text that I talked about this week. And then I'm going to share some, what I would call, some modern day interpretations of what the entirety of the biblical corpus calls us to do, or the way in which we understand ourselves as racialized Americans, and then how does the biblical corpus call us to action. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay, so on Monday, if you were not here with us, we discussed Numbers chapter 11, verses, it's on the bottom here in my stack, I'm sure I won't get to it quickly. Numbers 11. Yeah, it was 19 through 27. It was everything but 28. And in that scripture, we hear the story of Miriam and Aaron complaining about Moses' choice of spouses. And there is an interpretation out there in both the scholarly world and just the hermeneutic world, the way in which preachers particularly interpret the scripture for our modern day context, that says that their complaint against Moses' selection of wives was that she was an Ethiopian, or some versions of the Bible say because she was a Cushite. And I believe that you all have discussed in Bible study at 9 o'clock in the morning, and we discussed that morning, that Cush was used interchangeably throughout that biblical period to identify sub-Saharan Africa and the influence of sub-Saharan Africa in Egypt. And I argue that when did Egypt secede from the continent of Africa, then and even now? And so there is this influence that we find in the in biblical antiquity of na- each other, becoming members of each other's cultures, of each other's societies. And so that's how Kush was able to be used interchangeably. And so there are some scholarly interpretations that are varied in terms of why is it that in that particular scripture, the editor particularly lifts up that they were complaining that she was a Cushite. And Melanie was pointing out today that after they say that, they were complaining because she was a Cushite. They go on, and next to parenthetically say, because indeed she was a Cushite. And we'll find this in the scriptures that whenever you use an adjective, but emphasize the adjective in describing someone, that there's some meaning in there. And so we play with that for a little while. What does it mean that Cush means dark skin? It means Ethiopian. It means where you're from. It means what you look like. So what does that mean for us that possibly that Miriam and Aaron were not happy that their brother had married someone who was dark-skinned? And then we talked in that session, one of the scholarly interpretations is that from Miguel de la Torre in his book Reading the Bible from the Margins, says that quite possibly because the Israelites at that time, they weren't even Israelites yet, because the nomadic Jews of that time did not have a country. Remember, they had escaped Egypt. And that these Cushite people were a settled, and they were in some sense an aristocracy. So is it possible that there was some contention that Moses had married up? So I like that interpretation, not because it's the right one or it's the only one, it's the one I accept from my social cultural lens, but because it makes you say, And I believe the scriptures do that to us. And our challenge with the scriptures is that we don't back away from that pregnant not understanding, but that we approach the scripture, what I've been saying all week, with something called the hermeneutic of suspicion. That we always ask the question and we act on the question, what is not there for me to understand how I can begin to see myself, my feelings, my family, my colleagues, in what the biblical text is saying to me. So it doesn't mean the hermeneutic of suspicion means throw out the baby with the bathwater. It means stay in the question. And so we stayed in the question for a little while for the hour that we had on Monday with Aaron, Miriam, and Moses. So then on Tuesday, in our class, we took a New Testament text, and we looked at Luke. I should have written these down. We looked at Luke, I believe it's 17. I always write the scriptures in my handwritten notes. It's the bad thing. 17, was it 17? Mm-hmm. Okay. 11 through 19, the story of the 10 lepers who were, as Jesus was coming through Jerusalem, were walking near him and yelled out to Jesus, have mercy on us. And Jesus instructed them to go to the priest, to show themselves to the priest. And on their way, they became well. They were healed. And one turned back. And in that very same scripture, we have a very similar literary dynamic where we have the editor, the redactor, as they call them sometimes, pointing out, and he was a Samaritan. Again, so we have that adjective describing the person being highlighted in the text. And so we played around with what it meant for a Samaritan to be grateful for his healing. And what did it mean for us to begin to look at who were the other nine? So we talked about that, you know, who are the other nine in that context, and who are the other nine in our modern day context? And I suggested that the other nine could possibly be the butcher, the attorney, the
people with privilege?
Mm-hmm. People with privilege. They could be our neighbor, though. Mm-hmm. And they could be on their way home. You know, they've been put outside of their community for, I believe the period was, I think at least 7 days. May have been way longer than that. May have been three times that, because they functioned in groups of seven in scripture writing. So what was it like to be put out of your community for that long? And then to find out you're well, you're on your way to the priest. The priest is normal to go. If you have leprosy, it's normal to go to the priest so that you can be rejoined to your community. So we discussed the difficulty of what that context meant. What were the rules for, if there were rules, what was the code of conduct for gratitude? And we talked about that. Again, that was a conversation that we had. I had no right answers for that. And then on Wednesday, we talked about a very, very difficult text, for me anyway. And it comes out of Genesis 9. And the verses are, this book has been both my journal and my lesson plan. I believe the verses were 9 through 17. And we 9 through 27. And there we talk about the curse of Ham. And this is where Noah's sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth, J-A-P-E-T-H, J-A-P-H-E-T-H, Japheth, we believe is how you say that. After they had disembarked the Noah's ark, Noah at some time obviously had elapsed. He planted a vineyard and enjoyed the fruit of his labors and was a little inebriated one night, and Ham walks in and discovers his father drunk and naked. Believe it or not, there's a law about that. You're not supposed to disrespect your parents, and that's how it was interpreted. There may have been a law that you're not supposed to see your parents, take in your parents' nakedness, I believe. And so instead of Ham doing whatever the code was for that time, he went out and told his brothers, hey, dad's in there naked, you know, and drunk. And so the brothers, Shem and Japheth, walk in backwards and cover their father's nakedness. And when Noah wakes up from his stupor, he then allegedly curses Ham. But the scripture says when Noah awoke, he cursed Canaan and says that your sons will be hewers of wood and water and will be servants or slaves, depending on your translations, to his brothers. Well, that, guess how that has been interpreted over the years. So, of course, Canaan, Ham had a son named Canaan. So, and Ham also had a son named Cush. So here we go again with that. Is it that this person, is that the reason why we had at that time, it's gone now, this place called Cush? Or is that person dark-skinned? And did Ham then populate the dark-skinned people of the earth? And if so, then of course the dark-skinned people are supposed to be. But also there's an interpretation that Canaan was not in the original text. Because why would, if the curse is against Ham, why is it written in Canaan? Who did the Israelites hate in that context? Whose land did they, were they promised?
The Canaanites.
So how convenient that the Canaanites are cursed. You know what I mean? And what would even be a modern, non-racialized interpretation of that?
Like a Middle East.
Exactly.
Like our going into the Middle East.
Or even the Israelites, how we understand the Jews' occupation of Palestine. Again, again, you see our social, see my social cultural lens just going right in there? And I said to say that it's very important that we're able to apply this, see ourselves in the scriptures, apply the scriptures, but not necessarily for condemnation. It is a moral and ethical code, and it has value for that. But it is not a one-dimensional and a static document. And so for those 3 days, that's what we talked about. That was a very difficult scripture because it's very hard to refute some of those interpretations. No, it says right here, the Cushites, the Canaanites are cursed. We know those are black people. We know those are Palestinians. You know, we don't know that. But we know that, and therefore, you know, this is the proper appropriation of the scriptures, moral and ethical message to us now. So then yesterday, I pulled out some of our favorite scriptures, all of our favorite scriptures, from the New Testament, and they are what we understand as Pauline letters, the epistles. We all know the epistles. And I specifically talked about what's known as the Hostophelon, which is what is called, it's Latin for the household codes. And these are the scriptures in 1 Corinthians and Peter and Timothy. Not 1 Corinthians, I'm sorry, because that's Pauline. It would be in Colossians, Peter and Timothy, where it says, wives, obey your husbands. Mm-hmm. Children, to your fathers. Mm-hmm. Slaves, obey your masters. And we talked about the context of why the, what is the house of failure? Why does the Bible have household codes? Well, in the scripture, scholars code everything. Back in Genesis, when we were talking about the alleged curse of Ham, that's called the Table of Nations. Scholars look at that as the Table of Nations because it is understood that Noah populated the earth, and so all of his sons, of course, and that's the most of the Old Testament, the names of the male descendants of Israel, you know, Jacob named Israel, and his 12 sons that became those names later on. Well, same thing when Noah's sons were born, their names became names of nations, so we call it a Table of Nations. So scholars, you know, have a methodology, but it's not, you know, I mean, it's a way of dissecting context in the Old Testament. So the household codes are a way of understanding what is happening when these moral codes are being appropriated in these Pauline epistles, letters. And they're very troublesome. The woman who read the scripture had a hard time just reading it aloud. Which I thought was very, very interesting is that because a lot of times when we read, we ignore the scriptures that bother us. So we don't have to experience the pain. You know, or like in alleged curse of Ham, we read it and we totally don't even see that in one case it says Ham violated his father, but Canaan was cursed. We just don't see that because I think it's the lens that we bring to our scripture reading. That it's almost like hiking. I learned because I don't hike, so now since I've been at Holden, I'm now officially a hiker. And I realized that there are times when you hike, you don't hike for the destination. You're walking to be present with the experience. And that's a lot how reading the scripture is. Sometimes you want to be present with the experience, be present with the words on the page. And then how are those words organized in a certain context, and what is happening, what is not there for us to understand, what questions should we be asking, and then how do we then appropriate it. And so all of that said, that's what we talked about for the last 3 days, and what we have come up with is that the Bible is hard. It's a difficult document to read for face value. It's also painful, and it's been used painfully to suppress and to oppress. our challenge to begin to reclaim the value of our document. This is our document. It is a document that it is that documents God's unfathomable love for God's creation and how God continues to speak to us. How that document, again, is not a stagnant document, but one that continues to speak. So there was, this got misplaced somewhere in my chalet. I think we actually gave it back to the person who gave it to us. Paul Olson, who is the on staff here for the summer and is the coordinator of the teaching staff, loaned us a message that Barack Obama recently preached, I believe it was 2 months ago, at Jim Wallace's Sojourners conference. And if I can find the quote, because I couldn't find the actual speech, I thought it was very, very appropriate to what my challenge is to us. And then I want us to look at some scriptures of how the Bible challenges us to use it responsibly and accountably. This is what Barack Obama writes in his speech. And what he's talking about here, if I can set it up, is that he's talking to a room full of pastors. And of course, he's a senator, so he's saying, okay, yeah, not one of you, but you know, I'm as challenged as you all are with what my faith challenges me to do in my work, in my whole of my life. And so he talked about when he was running for senator in Illinois. I'm from Illinois, so I somewhat remember this. I was moving back to Illinois during the election. He was way up in the polls. I mean, he was a shoo-in, let's face it. I mean, literally 6 months before the election, the Republicans went and got some poor slob to run against them. You know, the guy was never going to be able to catch up. But the guy made an accusation against Senator Obama that pretty much said that his faith was wishy-washy, as was his politics. And he didn't have a stand, a moral stand, on a woman's right to choose. And his colleagues and his staff were like, you know, they just shot off a response because this came via, you know, on the internet. So I mean, it was out there on his website. So his staff responded with standard Democratic response. Mm-hmm. This is our story, we're sticking to it. Do you know what I mean? And he said that wasn't enough for him. It wasn't enough for him that he was 9 points ahead. It wasn't enough for him that that the Democrats had a stock response for his progressive stance. And he got an email from a doctor from the University of Chicago who said, I really can appreciate most of what you say, but I won't be able to vote for you because you say you're a progressive, but you invoke a very benign stance. I'd rather you say where you stand on the moral and ethical issues than to say nothing at all. I'd rather disagree with you wholeheartedly than to not have anything to disagree or agree with you on. So that disturbed him. And he stayed up all night and prepared a response and replied to that person. They ended up with a nice internet exchange. This is after he won the senatorial election, so he won. And they're still having this, he still has some issues with gentlemen. So when he's talking at the Sojourners conference, he makes this powerful point. Well, here's the first thing he says, I just love this. And I'm going to get to the PowerPoint next. This is the setup. After all, the problems of poverty and racism, the uninsured, the unemployed, are not simply technical problems in search of a perfect 10-point plan. They are rooted in both societal indifference and individual callousness and the imperfections of man. Mm-hmm. This guy is just, I'm sorry, guys, is prolific. I mean, because that's really it. I mean, this statement is a secular response to even what our religious conviction challenges us to do. We always want our faith, our church, our pastor, our Bible to give us a perfect 10-point plan so that we can remain indifferent and even callous to the responsibility that God has given us to be engaged in his human family. So he says the idea is that we are not independent, but that we are interdependent. And the idea that we are independent and not interdependent is evil. Now this is a powerful point he makes. He says that our interpretation of our own faith is diverse. And this is how he says it. He says, whose Christianity should we teach in our schools? Dobson's or Sharpton's? Which passage of the scripture should guide our public policy? Should we go with Leviticus, which suggests slavery is okay and eating shellfish is an abomination? Or should we stick with the Sermon on the Mount? This is powerful. Which is so radical that it is doubtful that even our own defense department would survive its application. So I'm going to stop talking because my flow is melting. Just because that's so powerful, I want that to kind of sit with you guys and tell me some of all the things I've said about how our social cultural lens and our understanding and misunderstanding of context. What are some of the things that stirs up for you? What does it mean for you to know that the Bible is both a very useful and valid and important tool in our faith life and also a weapon of mass destruction?
So I just came in today, so I got the review, and when we were going through the first couple of days, my question is, we're looking at it from our lens, either racially or culturally or historically at this point in time, but what about at that time? Was race and color, are we to believe that race and color was a divider even then? Because you say that the Christians were probably higher up in the kind of evolution of a kingdom and a society. So are we to think that there was prejudice of skin back then?
I think that we need to bring tools to our understanding of the context. So we need to really look at what, you know, if we're that hungry for what is really happening in that context. My understanding is that the tools that I have as far is that race was not, race as we understand it is, it's a modern day concept and it's a social construct. And we know that from just modern day science that says that there's no difference in any of us. So that at best race is a social construct. Is evil new? No. Evil is present in the very first chapter, in the very second chapter of the scripture. You know, so there's a young man sitting in the back room that Monday. He says, you know what, I think this is simply that she was different for whatever reason. And the tools that we bring to really unpacking the context to help understand the ways in which Zipporah was different. But for us to read in race into that is inappropriate because it wasn't. It was not a factor. There may not have been skin color. It's doubtful that there was skin color prejudice, but it's not doubtful that prejudice was absent. Does that make sense? Because skin color is not a factor there because you don't have until we get closer toward the movement of the gospel in the New Testament, do we have the movement toward what we call, and this is still darker skinned people, Asia Minor, which is probably modern day Turkey, mm-hmm. quite possibly. And this is what I've been told. This is not what I've read, you know. But so then we move up to into Rome, into the Roman Empire. So we don't get people who descended from the Caucasus Mountain until mm-hmm. later in the scriptures. Mm-hmm. So there can't be a dominant white culture in that time, which is in our modern day context, which is why racism is an issue, because the power dynamic for racism in our modern day culture is to support power for dominant culture, which is white, male, heterosexual. That's my issue. But that's our reality. That's what our isms are in our culture. That's what race is in our culture. And that was not part of the context, if that makes sense. Empires are moving radically, which is something that we've been talking about in Bible study. Is the Bible a political document in the first place?
I think the Old Testament world in particular is a Semitic world. And most of the peoples dealt with it tend to be Semitic. So I think the prejudices tend to be ethnic rather than racial. But I think at the same time, there are probably indications from art and political art of the time that suggest that there are probably some racial stereotypes too. When you see some of the carvings from the old Assyrian Empire, where Sennacherib and other are leading various nations off in chains. Among the people who are being led off in chains are Jewish folk, but among the people who are being carried off in chain are some Negroid folk who have some very typical racial qualities about them, and they look not only stereotypical, but almost as if they're political cartoonish.
Mm-hmm. You mean exaggerated
features? Yeah, right, mm-hmm. right. So I think there were probably some racial stereotypes at work even in that time, perhaps. But I think it's mainly ethnic.
I think it's more ethnic because I choose to believe it's more ethnic because when you read about Taharqa, you know, one of the famous kings of Egypt that the Israelites made alliances with so that they could annihilate the Assyrians. Probably a dark skinned, full nose, full lipped king. Several of the Egyptian dynastic kings were dark skinned, but many of them were Semitic, like you said. For me, I'm not that good with ethnic qualities outside the United States, so like someone from Greece, or if you know any Lebanese people, mm-hmm. with those type of features. North African, you know, quite likely. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have kings that look like that, and you're going to have kings that look distinctively racial as we understand it. Skin color and feature. But that's not lifted up in the text. You know, the text doesn't lift up the skin color prejudice. It doesn't lift up the prejudice. It doesn't even tell you what the prejudice is, that the prejudice exists. But it lifts up really more of the code, the violation of the code of conduct, mm-hmm. Typically against the law books, particularly the Leviticus code. But when you see the stories of the nations, you have an intermingling. If you were to look at our history, our American history, over the years, you look back and you see an intermingling in terms of like who were our allies. Mm-hmm. 20 years ago, and who are allies, you know. Mm-hmm. So you'll see a very similar pattern because we're looking. I remember when I first started teaching Sunday school, and I've been a seminarian. seminary just made a bad problem worse for me. But I remember thinking that when I would be preparing my lesson for the next day, I would remember going to tell my students all the time, it's like a horror movie. You know how when you're at a horror movie, the screen is down, you're sitting there watching, you got your popcorn, you're popping, you're all tense and everything, because you know, don't open the door. But they don't know that, because they're in the movie, and they can't hear you. Do you know what I mean? And that's how the scriptures are sometimes. We look at it from a movie. Like, did they know? You know, did they know Zipporah was dark-skinned? Do you know what I mean? Didn't they know Hammond's going to populate dark-skinned people and they were going to become American and Caribbean slaves? Do you know what I mean? No, because they're looking at it from over here. You know, we're over here. That makes a lot of sense because that justifies what we were born into. Not even what we intentionally are perpetuating. We were born into that. So doesn't that make sense? No, it doesn't make sense because they're just in the movie. They're just in their context. If that makes sense to you guys at all, I get a little passionate about these things. So I don't know, what do you think about that? I mean, does that make you begin to ask some questions? I mean, Bob and Ellie are gone now, so we're on our own. Unless Larry wants to help us out. I mean, in terms of really understanding how we begin to apply some of these things, do we say, okay, God, that's just a shame. I mean, I have a friend who... Some of you all may have been in session, some of you may not, who her brother told her just recently that his professor told he and his fellow African-American students that they were cursed. Mm-hmm. And it's in the Bible. Now, we can all say, oh, that's so bad, but that man believes that. Do you know what I mean? He goes to our church. No, he's teaching our kids. He's teaching our white kids that they have internalized privilege and superiority, despite himself. He's teaching our African-American kids that they are supposed to have internalized inferiority. Does that make sense?
No, it doesn't make sense.
You know why it doesn't? Because we don't know how systemic it is. And my challenge to us is not to bring to the scriptures a systemic reading of the scripture. To begin to ask the question, like Mary said, well, no, actually, I've seen in the art that there's people that were black with, you know, Negroid features. The whole idea of Negroid, you know, concept? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not heard of in the context of scriptures. You know what I mean? That's someone who was paid. Literally, we're not paid, but incented to delineate race.
The only thing I could never understand, because if Ham and Japheth and Shem were all sons of, they all had to look the same, because they're all sons of the same father and the same mother. Mm-hmm. And so for somebody to say, well, this one is different, intellectually, I could never understand why that would work. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Because what did without the Mary Zipporah's people? You know Zipporah with the Cushite?
Yeah.
Indeed she was from Sub-Saharan Africa, which Sub-Saharan Africa, likely you're gonna be darker skin. But quite possibly not, because South Africa is a Sub-Saharan.
Yeah, but way back before the Dutch came, right. It would have been
more Aboriginal. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, right, and there's a lot of movement that's not that we can only read into the text. We don't know how. Why did we know? Why wasn't Ethiopia just Ethiopia? Why was it Kush sometimes and Ethiopia other times? And Egypt at other times. And there's a reason for that. Believe me, the scholars, people have paid a lot of money to study this. Do you know what I mean? And there is a reason for that. And sometimes it's accurate as it can be, that because of the political movement in that time, that, you know, Egypt was in its formational stages. So so we called it Ethiopia. Ethiopia, believe it or not, has had some very powerful dynasties in biblical antiquity. So,
I'm looking at the descendants of Ham, and in some ways it's just a collection of everybody that causes problems to Israel. It's Cush and Seba, which is probably Sheba.
Seba, uh-huh.
Descendants of Rama is Nimrod, the mighty warrior. Nimrod's kids, over the beginning of his kingdom, was Babel. Then from that land he went on to Assyria and built Nineveh. Worst city in the old world. Egypt became the father of the Philistines. Canaan became the father of Sidon, the Jebusites and the Amorites and so on. All their enemies are just sort of listed in that category. Mm-hmm. These are all Ham's kids, you know.
Right.
See what happens.
And it's a conundrum for me. It's a real, and I can share this with you, my own story, and I just don't know how in an hour you can have any experience with the scripture, but yesterday, yesterday I had Dr. Felder's book, and I had a book that he edited that we have here in the library in Holden, and it's called Stoning the Road We Trod, and he's also the editor of the Journal of Religious Thought. And so, when I first year in seminary, we have three classes, Old Testament Survey, New Testament Survey, Church History Survey. They're all survey because you're getting all the information thrown at you. And my Old Testament professor is Eugene Rice. And of course, Rice writes an article. He studies, or he writes about the kings. But he writes an article in the Journal of Religious Thought on the Curse of Ham. And for the longest, I had never heard of the Curse of Ham. And the article is entitled The Alleged Curse of Ham. And so whenever I would talk about it after I'd been in this class, I always said, well, if you heard about the alleged curse of Ham, well, no, it's not the alleged curse of Ham, it's the curse of Ham. But because the first time I heard about it was the alleged, it was the article we had to read. And as we were discussing it in class, so I read it, it's like you read the Bible. I read it, I was like, that's an interesting interpretation. Good stuff, can we get class to talk about it? It didn't impact me at all, because it was like, it's an article. And as he unpacked it for us, I am not prone to headaches other than sinus headaches during sinus season. In the class, my head hurt so bad, I had to leave class. Because I couldn't wrap my personal history around an interpretation. I never heard of it. You know, and this is how it was interpreted. So this justified enslavement of darker skinned people.
No, was he, when he was presenting this, he was presenting it as the truth. I mean, as...
He was presenting it academically.
Okay, like, this is what the people used.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and then his article refutes it.
Okay.
But but I couldn't get past, people say this is a justification for enslaving? I mean, I just didn't... You just go through life happily. If, even for me, reading the Bible from a monocultural perspective, that you know, it's a benign document. It's not a benign document at all. You know, and it's not even, at that point I wasn't even thinking about having to preach the text ever or anything. It was just understanding the Old Testament. You know, that was the name of the book we used even. But I had no idea. And then I found it in our book, you know. So you start looking, researching, you find that this is a well-documented assertion.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, in that very class, I had a response that actually caused me to have a headache, and I had to go home for the rest of the day because I couldn't grasp that at all. So.
Can you expand the concept of race and races? You've got some glaring omissions because there's no one from the Orient that's in this book. So is there, in your experience and your looking into this, some prejudices, if you will, for that absence towards people from Asia?
I also think about the Mayan Indian.
Southern.
Yeah, where are they in the text? That's a question. And what, this is very simplistic because I'm not a scholar. And what I have come to from reading De La Torre and Felder, and there's a new young African American scholar, who uses the African American lens. What I have determined from their writings and my own understanding is that, and this is what Bob has been saying all week, that the scriptures, just what Larry lifted up, really are a political document for their context. And as the scriptures are written from a Semitic, most of the Old Testament is written about what's happening around the Fertile Crescent, as if the entire rest of the world. Now, Rome was a major empire, very much highlighted in the New Testament. Did it just appear on the face of the earth? Do you know what I mean? When after the 400 year, obviously it was there. But the writers are writing about their God encounter, the encounter of their God. And this is a document of what happens. What happens with their God and how they understand the story. And then the same document is how we say things are interpreted and reinterpreted, things are edited and re-edited, just like we have the King James Version and the New King James Version and the Revised Standard Version and the New Revised Standard Version. And as we revise and edit, and even before we even got those, before Luther even translated the book from Greek into German, it was translated several times in Greek. And so there's a suspicion by the authors that I have read that, particularly with the alleged curse of Ham, I believe it's alleged, the story is it's the curse of Ham, is that the redactor, the editor, went in and changed the story from Ham being cursed for a violation of a code of conduct to these people are specifically cursed because they are in the way of our political. They justify our political agenda.
Plus, you have the centuries of oral before it's ever written down. All those.
A leap of weapons of mass destruction that we
exactly. Mm-hmm. Think about how homosexuality is being used right now. And as I read on that, it's painful when I read. I'm reading scholars that I respect and honor and say it's an abomination. And these are scholars that say it's an abomination. But as you understand homosexuality, that's not what it was in the Bible, but it still is not, the Bible, what they're saying is the Bible has this context and says this, and this is what's happening in the Bible. But the Bible does not condone same-sex love as we know in our modern-day context. It just breaks my heart. But you get all the way there, and then you make this shift. But then it affirms exactly what I've been saying all week, that all of us, despite ourselves, bring our social, cultural lens to the reading of the story of God's encounter with humanity. That particular, we have a secessionist, am I saying this right, Larry? A secessionist faith. We don't have just the New Testament, but we, our faith succeeds, it expands from the faith of the Hebrew Israelites, just like Islam does. It's not a standalone faith, it's part of the tree. And so from that, we need to understand what that faith was. There's scholarship out there that says that Zipporah, the Cushite, that Moses actually met Yahweh on the fields of on Jethro's fields. So if she was black, those black people were worshiping Yahweh before the Israelites were. Okay, now we're all messed up. Do you know what I mean? Because how can we bring our social cultural lens to that when it's the story of the Hebrew Israelites? They were black. Or they had some type of race, you know, intermingled with them. You know, it gets deep. And my encouragement to you is, and we're going to go to these scriptures real quick. Maybe we'll just go to the one. You guys write those down and take a look at those. We'll go to this one. I'll try to pass.
I'll listen.
Take turns reading this as our challenge as we move forward. But I said all this to say that as we come to the scriptures, that we understand that the message is valid today, and it's a valuable message. Someone asked me this the other night. When I read the story of the movement of the Israelites, you know, and their constant punishment and receiving of grace, and they're going back into the cycle of punishment and grace, I see myself in that story. You know, I see myself as someone who, as Paul, you know, when I want to do right, evil is all around me. You know, now, do I believe that God is always punishing me, or do I believe sometimes I'm making my own hell? You know what I mean? And I'm living that hell, quite possibly. But that there's some validity in that. I mean, when I first became a substitute, I couldn't read Paul. I'm like, that guy is nuts. You know, he hates women. You know, a literal reading, and one that doesn't allow you to ask the question, what is missing there? Why is this being said? You know, to just stop cheat you out of the experience of what the message of God's unfathomable love and grace is. And it's right there in our document. So again, I encourage you not to throw out the baby with the bathwater, stay with the text. And then if someone reads the first part of this text, 1 Corinthians 12, those first two, and if someone reads 14 through 20, the rest of it, I would appreciate it. Slow and deliberate, so this is our charge as we move forward.
I'll read the first part here. For just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, through many, are one body, so it is with Christ. For in the one Spirit we were all baptized into one body, Jews or Greeks, slave or free, and we were all made to drink of one Spirit.
Indeed, the body does not consist of one member, but of many. If the foot would say, because I am not a hand, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. And if the ear would say, because I am not an eye, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would the hearing be? If the whole body were hearing, where would the sense of smell be? But as it is, God arranged the members in the body, each one of them, as he chose. If all were a single member, where would the body be? As it is, there are many members, yet one body.
Any last-minute comments? Any thoughts? I think that's
the trump card.
Huh?
That's the trump card.
I think the church at large of the ELCA is very concerned. We're not a growing church. We're losing members. There's just a very small percentage of people of, you know, of color in the church. That's a big problem. And
Turn off the tape.
Well, that's a question we need to be asking, I think, in our context, of the people in our context.
And I think it's not just how can we be more welcoming so that people can come in and benefit from being with us. It's that we need the rest of the body. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're just an ear, you know, how do we move?
Yeah. Right?
We need those different parts of the body. And I think that's maybe the urgency that needs to inform us.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very true. That's very true. One of the things I was going to open up with is that I've given you guys a summary of what I talked about all week long. What I was just going to say is that I presented problems all week long. Mm-hmm. And I don't have any solutions today, but I have what Larry's calling the trump card. I have the other part of the story. And the way that Paul was able to internalize and apply it and find it to be faithful for him. That it's not enough for us to come to our context and say, we have a problem. You know what I mean? When I first started Corporate America, I remember I was just as passionate about the work I did then as I am about this work. So I would, you know, just get mad. And I had, thank God, a wise cube mate that said, never bring your boss a problem. Mm. Always bring your boss a solution. Mm. You know, so I think that even applies in this context. You know, now some things just can't take, you know, I have plenty of solutions, like who I should marry. If I take him, the guy, he just doesn't listen. But, or he doesn't respond anyway. But when we come to our context, the solution isn't readily available. It's not the 10-point plan that Barack Obama, the nice, neat 10-point plan that Barack Obama talks about, but that we are in the conversation, we stay in the conversation with our scriptures, and we stay in the conversation with people in that church, and we stay in the conversation with people who are different from us. When I moved to D.C., I joined a church that I did not know was primarily gay and lesbian. Mm-hmm. And right there in the bulletin, it says, on the, you know, the back of the bulletin, what's happening this week, whatever, right there in the back of the bulletin, it was like, gay, lesbian, fellowship, every Sunday at 4 o'clock. And I was like, oh my God. They have fellowship with these people. You know? So, and I went. I like those people. And they told me that they were born that way. And I was like, get out of here. I already had it. I wrote a paper about how you got born that way. It's not natural. I go, you know, I did scholarly, you know, I did work on it. And they were like, I know, but I was. And staying in that conversation with them, it wasn't a matter of them convincing me. I was able to see it. I could never say, I know what it means to love someone and always be attracted to someone of the same sex. I don't know what that means. But I know what it means to be in community with someone who's different than me. And how much that adds to my experience. So I think that's, you know, that's our challenge. It's a process. I have one thing I want to share with you. I mean, because the tape can be off. That Barack, also that Barack said that really, I mean, okay, he's my favorite person in the whole world. Not really, but he's one of them. Democracy demands that the religiously motivated translate their concerns into a universal rather than religion-specific values. It demands their proposals be subject to argument and amenable to reason. I may be opposed to abortion for religious reasons, but if I seek to pass laws banning the practice, I cannot simply point to the teachings of my church or invoke God's will. I have to explain why abortion violates some principle that is accessible for people of all faiths, including those who have none. Mm. We can just do it. We could do a teaching series just on that alone. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think that's powerful. We have to get with the scripture, get uncomfortable with it, you know, sit with it, and then we have to figure out how does it apply to the people God has charged us to stand with, to be in community. There's no answers here.
but they may be there. So, thank you all so much for